Let's follow up now on the winners of the 2010 Nobel Prize for Economics. It goes to three different men, two Americans and one, a native of Cyprus now living in Great Britain. The Americans are Peter Diamond of MIT and Dale Mortensen of Northwestern, and the committee also gave the award to Christopher Pissarides of the London School of Economics. We're going to talk about what these three men did with NPR's Jim Zaroli. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
And sometimes these Nobel Prize winners in economics are involved with very abstract economic theory, but this time they're looking into something that's extremely relevant to many, many people's lives right now.
Yes, it has to do with unemployment, job vacancies. The committee said the three men had developed models that help us understand the ways that unemployment, wages, and job vacancies are affected by regulation and economic policy. More specifically, they won for their analysis of markets with search frictions, to put it in somewhat more esoteric terms. And by search frictions, that means, any factors that keep the markets from operating efficiently.
Okay, what's an example of that? When you talk about, you're talking about the labor market here, so I'm looking for a job, I'm putting out my resume. What's a search friction there?
Well, for instance, even in times of really high unemployment, like now, we have jobs that go unfilled. That is even true today. When we have a 9.6% unemployment rate in the United States. So the question is, what gets in the way of someone filling that job? And it could be a number of things. It may have to do with something as simple as the way the job is advertised, or, probably more likely the kinds of skills that are needed. Or maybe job hunters don't really understand that they have the skills that's needed for a job, so they don't apply. At any rate, it takes time and resources to look for work. So there can be kind of a temporary mismatch between job openings and finding the right candidate. Oh, and that's what's meant by a search friction, and it's the thing that the winners were cited for.
I'm thinking of the phrase skill mismatch, which is this idea that sometimes in a particular city or state, you don't have the same work skills in the workforce that you actually need for the jobs that are open at the moment. That's the kind of thing we're talking about here, right?
Exactly. And that's something that exists at all times, really. But in times like this, when there are so many people out of work, it's especially relevant because, you think there are people out there that really need jobs, and there are probably jobs that they might be suitable for if they just knew about them and knew how to get them.
Now, Jim, you were with us earlier this morning and told us a few of the people who were on the short list, the public short list for this award. And you also told us the winners usually aren't on the short list and aren't part of the speculation. Were these three guys part of the speculation?
No, they're not. In fact, they're not especially well known to the public at all, with one exception, and that is Peter Diamond. He's actually been in the news this year. Diamond is an expert on Social Security and pensions. He was nominated by President Obama to fill one of the vacancies on the Federal Reserve Board, but his nomination was held up by the Senate. They basically went home without acting on his nomination. The ranking member of the Senate Banking Committee, Richard Shelby of Alabama, said he wasn't sure that Diamond had the kind of broad macroeconomic experience that you need to serve on the Fed. Obviously, the president says he's going to resubmit the nomination, and this probably changes the dynamics a bit of Diamond's appointment.
Nobel Prize can do that. Jim, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Jim Zaroli, and again, the winners of the Nobel Prize for Economics, Peter Diamond, Dale Mortensen, and Christopher Pissarides. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Vaccines have tamed killers like smallpox, polio, and measles. But some newer vaccines, like the ones for whooping cough and chickenpox, don't always give such great protection. In fact, that leads some parents to wonder if it might be better for their kids to get the diseases instead of the vaccines. NPR's Nancy Shute reports.
It's 2:30 on Tuesday afternoon, and the moms and babies are gathering at Angela Shogren's townhouse in Alexandria, Virginia.
Here's a pretty baby!
As the babies crawl across the basement floor, the moms talk about breastfeeding and lack of sleep. One issue keeps coming up, vaccines.
What am I giving my kid? I didn't know.
To expose so many of these little tiny bodies to so many at once feels not prudent.
I am definitely pro immunization. However, I feel like we're giving way too many.
Like the other moms there, Angela, Kirsten Petrucci, and Vanessa Voden are all vaccinating their children. But there's a lot they don't like about that process. They'd like the shot schedule spaced out more so a tiny baby isn't getting 4 or 5 shots at once. They wonder if a 6-month-old really needs a seasonal flu shot. And Katie Combs wonders if shots are really necessary for less serious diseases like rotavirus and chickenpox.
But I think a natural immunity for a lot of not serious illnesses such as chickenpox may be better than getting the vaccines.
Is natural immunity better than the industrial version? Dr. Samuel Katz helped invent the measles vaccine, and he says that's a good question and one with no easy answer.
It varies from vaccine to vaccine.
That's because some vaccines are a lot better at getting your immune system to respond than others. Katz says when immunologists design a vaccine, they want it to activate 2 parts of the immune system, antibodies and cell-mediated immunity. That's what our bodies know how to do naturally when they come across a bad bug. Some vaccines can prompt that immune response, too.
We think that's what we've achieved with measles. We think that's what we've achieved with polio.
But other vaccines don't always set off that 2-fisted attack, and scientists don't know why.
We have vaccines such as the one to prevent whooping cough. And we're seeing right now in California, where they're having a large outbreak, a number of the cases are individuals who've received vaccine.
Whooping cough is not the only disease where people can still get sick if they've had the vaccine. With chickenpox, about 25% of children got sick or spread the virus after getting 1 shot. Anne Gershon is a chickenpox expert at Columbia University Medical Center. She says then you got to give it another shot. Literally.
We really need boosters of vaccines much more than we thought we ever would.
So in 2006, the CDC added a 2nd chickenpox shot to the recommended childhood vaccines. Gershon says it looks like that's going to keep children from getting sick. She thinks the vaccine won't ever eradicate the virus, the way smallpox vaccinations got rid of smallpox. But she thinks it's still worth having.
I think it's important also to keep in mind with these infections that we look at not only dying or mortality, but we look at suffering or morbidity. And with this vaccine, we've not only decreased mortality, but we've decreased suffering from the virus.
Gershon remembers what it was like before the vaccine, when she cared for children who had come down with pneumonia or even flesh-eating bacteria, rare complications of chickenpox. Vaccines may not be perfect, but Gershon thinks that even an imperfect tool can help make sure children don't have to suffer. Nancy Shute, NPR News.
And that's your health for this Monday morning. The first mass-produced plug-in electric cars sold in the United States are set to hit auto showrooms by the end of this year. The Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt already have tens of thousands of pre-orders, so this type of car appears to be ready to move beyond the domain of tech hobbyists and environmentalists. Still, there are plenty of questions about their feasibility. Here's Andrea Kissick of member station KQED in San Francisco.
I have never been into cars. I don't know an oil filter from an air filter. But my 15-year-old Honda is on its last legs, and recently I've been curious about alternative fuels. So, with electric cars around the corner, my dream of green motoring suddenly seems possible.
Okay, already it looks different.
I spent some time behind the wheel of a shiny new, powder blue, all-electric Nissan Leaf, an aerodynamic 4-door hatchback with a range of 100 miles. Paul Hassan from Nissan joins me for a test drive outside the San Francisco Giants ballpark.
You're going to want to turn on the car by stepping on the brake.
It's roomy.
Oh, yeah.
I'm surprised because I'm like almost 5'10", and oftentimes in these small cars, I'm not comfortable.
You'll find that the rear seat is equally as roomy.
As Hassan launches into car salesman speak, I search for the brake.
This is the brake, the big
yes,
one.
Yes, yes.
And this is the gas pedal.
Yes.
Oh, wait, you don't call it the gas pedal. What would you call it? The power?
It would be an accelerator pedal.
Accelerator.
The dashboard overwhelms me with a confusing array of digital displays. There's some kind of interactive bar graph that I think is supposed to tell me when I'm about to run out of juice. And a satellite map of charging stations I can use. Not very many of them at this point. More on that later. After several attempts to start the car...
Whoops, I hit it twice. That was too fast. Push it in, push my brake on.
You have to
now,
press...
I'm already can't even get this.
You have to depress the brake.
I finally managed to start the car, and much like hybrids, I can't really hear anything. As we drive up over the Bay Bridge toward Berkeley, I notice a blind spot because of the small back window. Otherwise, I find my excitement building as the car zooms along.
So one of the things is this car goes fast. I mean, when you were talking, I noticed I was 72 miles an hour. I didn't even know it. Yep. I mean, wow.
Top speed is 90 miles per hour.
I could get a ticket in this car. It's a wild feeling, driving without a tailpipe. The downside, instead of a gas tank, which might run an average of 300 miles, a big lithium-ion battery pack sits under the car. One charge only lasts for about 100 miles. I need to figure out how to get around with this kind of limited range. So I check in with car guru Carl Brower, an editor at Edmunds.com.
You have to probably have a secondary vehicle that you know is a backup that you can utilize.
What? I need to buy two cars? Isn't there something else I can do?
What people need to do is get better about planning and not assuming that they can just go out and run four different errands coming back and forth each time.
I'm also going to have to think about how I use my radio, heater, wipers. They can all run a battery down pretty quickly. And that's where the competition thinks it has an advantage. GM's new midsize Chevy Volt is a hybrid, yes, but a new type of hybrid, a plug-in. It will go 40 miles on pure battery power, but then when that juice runs out, it can go another 300 miles on gas power. GM couldn't make a Volt available for me to test drive, but at a little more than $33,000 after federal tax credits, the car is just too expensive for me. I asked GM's Shad Balk, why the high price tag?
I don't believe the Volt is so expensive. I mean, it's an electric car that can be your only car. So the value that you get out of this car is a pretty good deal.
But Nissan's all-electric Leaf is just $20,000 after state and federal tax credits. That's just more affordable. And it would get me one of California's coveted carpool stickers for low-emission vehicles. But one thing still haunts me, that fancy satellite map on the Nissan Leaf dashboard, showing less than a handful of charging stations out there. I don't want to run out of juice and be stranded by the side of the road. Even driving solo in the Diamond Lane isn't worth that. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Kissick.
And tomorrow, Andrea goes in search of a battery charge.